sandy gray brown uniform of the army is omnipresent. You can hardly drive 5 kilometers on any road without coming across a cluster of young soldiers waiting for a bus and whiling away their time trying to catch a ride. In Israel, universal military service is, of course, obligatory on everyone, young girls as well as young men. And the soldiers and their lorries and their guns, and the almost hourly overflight of interceptor aircraft, inevitably reminds the visitor that Israel is a beleaguered nation, and that the neighbors of Israel are pledged to its eradication, to what they call the War of Liberation, or the final solution to the Palestine problem. There are almost nightly incidents along the border. While we were there this summer, the Syrian army was suddenly mobilized and massed on the Galilean front. First it was the Fedayeen, then the El Fateh, two Arab words which describe the same phenomenon. Arab legionnaires recruited from among the flotsam of the refugee and neighboring population, who act as commandos and as guerrillas, who invade Israel stealthily at night, dynamite buildings, farms, murder, sow what confusion they can. This has been the tension of Israel life for the last 18 years, ever since its establishment. And one would believe that by now the Israeli soul was inured to violence. But one of the striking facts of Israel, 1966, is its calmness, its openness, its imperturbability. The iron has not yet rusted the Jewish soul. My children could walk the several blocks from our hotel to the city park and play there for hours unchaperoned. They quickly found that their new playmates had many toys, but very few toy guns, and very few toy soldiers. A young girl will be allowed by her parents to hitchhike from Tel Aviv to Haifa, any place in Israel. She is perfectly safe on the roads, as she is perfectly safe on the streets of Jaffa or Tel Aviv at any hour of the day or night. And when you go to pay a visit on an Israeli couple, you are not ushered into a glass cage where you are investigated and interrogated before you're allowed to go into the lobby. I had not realized until we spent this summer in Israel how inured we have become to violence and how submissive we have become to it. Our young children and our wives live actually in a very narrow corridor of safety. And we allow them out only usually by themselves in the daylight hours. So it's really not surprising when an Israeli shakes his head in disbelief at an American host who prates about the good life here. Of course we have much more, but not much more of all that counts. His whole country is his. He lives in his cities, and he enjoys them, and he is free, she is free, to walk about them. The Israeli has learned to live with tension and to live with violence and to keep his humanity, and to keep a sense of humor. While we were in Israel, a wonderful little article appeared in the press. The one relatively safe border is the very short border between the Lebanon and Israel. And this is the article. all the world loves a lover. And yesterday's ruling by the Supreme Court in a border crossing case was just additional proof. Mordecai Moshe, age 21, was appealing to the court against the 6 months jail sentence he had been ordered to serve by the Haifa District Court. Speaking on his own behalf, he told how he had been out with his girlfriend, Rivka Shmuel, age 18, last October, for a walk near Rosh HaNikra. At her urging to seek a secluded spot, and against his better judgment, the couple crossed the border into Lebanon. Finding the spot that they were looking for, they remained there for some time, but they had been seen. A Lebanese police officer had spotted them the moment they crossed the border. He courteously waited a minute or two before he walked to them and made the arrest. The girl was sent home the following day, and Moshe 4 days later. In December, he was tried and convicted in the Haifa District Court. Yesterday, Moshe's tearful plea for mercy, coupled with a statement that he and Ms. Shmuel are to be married, touched at least Judge Benjamin Cohn's heart. He turned to Assistant State Attorney Gideon Chassid as a young man who might be expected to show tolerance and understanding of the young couple's desire to be alone. Mr. Chassid, the prosecutor, was nevertheless of the opinion that the border could not be allowed to become, quote, an appurtenance to romance, unquote. The court reduced the sentence from 6 to 2 months, and Moshe, who has been 2 months in jail already, walked across the courtroom, a free man, straight into the arms of his waiting fiancée. Now, the war in Vietnam threatens our cities and our economy quite as much as it threatens our army and our prestige. And so it is that the question of safety, of defense, of political questions, are the primary ones in Israel, for they threaten all other developments within the Israeli economy, within Israeli culture, all that Israel has created. And so I'd like to spend the minutes at our disposal this morning talking about the future policies of Israel and its hopes and opportunities for peace, and to spend next week as a conclusion to this report on our visit, telling you something of the more intimate details of Israeli life, some of the problems of education, of earning a living, some of the opportunities of culture, art, and music, and the like, which exist in Israel. Policy, foreign policy, is the predominant issue around the equation of war or peace. All else depends. And one Thursday afternoon, when we were driving south through Rehovot on our way to Be'er Sheva, we suddenly heard the sound of jet engines at full throttle, and a squadron of these delta-winged French Mystère fighter interceptors, which are now part of the Israeli Air Force, darted across our sight from a hidden air base nearby. We saw them wheel north at supersonic speeds. About an hour later, Kol Yisrael, the Israeli radio station, interrupted its afternoon musical program to announce that a bombing raid had been carried out against Syrian tractors and trenching equipment, building a cofferdam across one of the upper tributaries of the Jordan River. Now, why had this particular target been chosen? The raid was a reprisal. The raid was a reprisal for the dark, large headlines of the morning. The night before, some El Fateh, some of these marauders, had crossed the Syrian border, dynamited homes in Kfar Yuval, two farmers had been killed in their beds, planted landmines at Al-Magor, one of the border farm settlements, and the father of five had been killed that morning driving his tractor out to the fields. But why this particular target? You are familiar, I am sure, with the Jordan Water Valley Authority. The Jordan Water Valley Authority is a system of conduits and pipes which draws the water from the Sea of Galilee south, some 150 miles into the arid regions of the Negev. Much of the Negev could be cultivated, but it lacks water. The land there receives less than 0.4 inches of rainfall a year. Now in the Galilee, there is an abundant rainfall, and there is all the water which comes down through the various upper reaches of the Jordan River into the Sea of Galilee. And for centuries, this water has simply flown down the rocky defile of the Jordan Valley cleft into the brine of the Dead Sea, where it has passed into uselessness. It is salty and can no longer give life. And every scheme for the redevelopment of the Near East, which has been drawn up by anyone in the past 100 years, has included the need to establish an equivalent of our Tennessee Valley Authority, a Jordan Valley Authority, which would draw off waters from the upper reaches of the Jordan to the arid and parched lands of the Negev in Israel and of the Transjordanian Plateau east of the Jordan River. In 1954, United States roving ambassador Eric Johnston gained the signatures of the hydraulic engineers and the agronomists of all the neighboring nations to a water resource allocation treaty, which set forth how much water each of the nations could draw from this watershed. Now, the Arab heads of states refused to sign the treaty, which had been initialed by their expert subordinates. They were unwilling to admit that Israel existed. To sign a treaty which was signed also by Israel would have granted to Israel de facto recognition. They refused to be party to any agreement which seemed to give Israel an advantage, even though it was only a proportionate advantage, and one which would give life and greenness to the entire area. Nevertheless, all of the international aid agencies who lend money to the developing nations insisted that this 1954 agreement was in being. And they lent money to the Jordanian government to build what are known as the East Gore and the West Gore Canal irrigation projects within the terms of this 1954 allocation proposals. Israel went ahead building the Jordan Valley Authority, the conduit from the Galilee to the Negev, within the terms of this 1954 agreement. Early in 1964, the Jordanian government began to draw water from the Jordan River for use in its irrigation projects. Israel announced that the tap would be turned on the Jordan Valley Authority sometime in 1965. The Arab response was for General Nasser to convene in January of 1965 a pan-Arab head of state summit conference in Cairo, at which the threat was made, openly and blatantly, that if Israel drew waters from the Galilee, the Arabs would wage war immediately against Israel. But unfortunately, the times were not propitious for this belligerency. Nasser, who controls the most effective army among the Arabs in the area, had his army fully committed in the Yemen. Inter-Arab policy disputes were becoming exacerbated. Jordan and Egypt, Jordan and Syria were not cooperating as they once had. And so when in 1965 the waters were turned on, war did not eventuate. But Nasser reconvened in Cairo a summit conference of the Arab heads of states, and that conference, two preliminary and substitute programs were set in being, which were designed to increase the effectiveness of the war of liberation, as they call it, when this war is actually launched. In the first place, it was determined in late summer of 1965 to bring into being a foreign legion of Arab troops, a legion which we now call the Palestine Liberation Organization, who would be a group of professional commandos who would constantly have the border in turmoil and who would be the first wave of the attack by the Arab states when the attack was leveled. The second proposal, which was brought forth at Cairo, was a proposal to build a series of dams across the headwaters of the Jordan in Syria. Now, these dams were not designed to be irrigation projects. Quite the contrary. Syria receives sufficient rainfall for her fields. These dams were nuisance dams, designed simply to cut the water flow into the Jordan, into the Sea of Galilee, to turn the fresh water of these rivers to the west, where they would flow into the salt of the Mediterranean. And the financing of these two projects, well, you and I were to finance them through our cars. They were to be financed by the oil royalties from the oil leases in Kuwait and in Iraq. And in fact, they are so being financed. Now, the Israelis chose to bomb one of these coffer dams, one of these diversionary dams. But they did not simply bomb a damming project which they disliked. The retaliation, the reprisal was flown because in the last 6 months, in the 6 months preceding mid-July of 1966, there had been 12 serious El Fateh incursions of Israel. Almost 20 Israelis had been murdered. The damage to property had run into the tens of thousands of dollars. And as Prime Minister Levi Eshkol said simply that afternoon on the radio, it is unthinkable that the Syrians should dispatch marauders against Israeli farmers on the assumption that they are immune against our reaction. Israel had come to the end of its patience. The normal channels of diplomatic protest are closed to Israel. Syria was openly boasting of the success of these attacks, and the El Fateh were openly claiming credit for them. Now, these attacks are proof, if proof be needed, that the Near East is still a tense area, the tinder is dry, and that the match is lit. Nor did this attack, this reprisal attack, cause these commando raids to cease. As recently as 2 weeks ago, El Fateh marauders from Jordan bombed and destroyed a hydroelectric generator in the Negev near Arad. The Palestine Liberation Organization, which 18 months ago was no more than a Cairo resolution, is in being. There are now 12,000 troops in the Sinai Peninsula under the leadership of one Ahmed Zoukeri, an ex-Nazi propagandist, an absolutely irresponsible firebrand, who has gained the equipment for these troops of all places from communist China. Such is the activity of these 12,000 members of this Arab Legion of Murder. And a month ago, when Secretary U Thant made his report on various UN activities around the world to the General Assembly of the United Nations, he warned the United Nations against cutting the Gaza Emergency Force below its present complement of 3,400 men. And he spoke quite openly of the increased terror activities of these Arab marauders. The tinder is dry, and the match is lit. And there is, as there has been throughout the last 18 years, the danger of war in the Middle East. The arms race has been accelerated and exacerbated. In the last 3 years, the Soviet Union has given to Egypt, to General Nasser, some $2+ billion worth of modern military equipment, 550 warplanes, including 130 MiG-21s, which we have found in Vietnam to be among the best in the world, light and heavy bombers and the like, 1,200 heavy tanks, 90 warships, 100 ground-to-air missiles, another 100 ground-to-ground missiles, 400 pieces of heavy cannon and the like. In the same period of time, the Soviet Union has given to Syria 200 planes, 400 tanks. It's just beginning to bring together and to build in Syria a missile attack system. China has been providing the Palestine Liberation Organization with its guns. The United States is providing Patton tanks and Skyhawk medium bombers and an anti-aircraft system to Jordan. And Israel, of course, has bought arms to counter this, to act as a deterrent in almost all the Western capitals of the world. The arms race has been exacerbated and accelerated. And always when there is an arms race, there is a danger that it will suddenly flare. There will be a firefight which will escalate, and that there will be war. But one must add, though the Arabs continue to demand war, to threaten war, though the arms are pouring into the Middle East at an unprecedented rate, if practical policy, practical considerations rule passion, and that's a big if practical considerations rule political passion, then at least in the short term, we are unlikely to see an attack on Israel. And the reason lies in the inability at the moment for a coordinated large-scale attack by Israel's neighbors and enemies. Nasser has his army committed in the Yemen. The Yemen is a small hilly land in the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula. Some 5 years ago, Nasser sponsored a revolution against the royalist government in Yemen. There are parallels between his interests in Yemen and our interests in Vietnam. He thought it would be a rather simple revolution. He began by sending to his puppet Salah a few advisors. But victory was hard to come by. And the advisors became technicians. And then the technicians took off their civilian clothes and became fighting troops. Then a few hundred technicians became a few thousand. Then the few thousand became almost the total effective fighting force of the Egyptian army. Some 50,000 Egyptian troops are pinned down in the Yemen, because not only is he fighting the royalists, but he is fighting a group, a powerful bloc supporting the royalists, the King Faisal and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And as he escalates the war, the enemy escalates in response. King Faisal pours in more money, more equipment, and more men, and the war is a bloody standoff. Less and less have the people of Yemen wanted to fight this war. About a year ago, there were serious efforts to mediate it. Nasser's own revolutionary government seemed willing to such an agreement. What did Mr. Nasser do? Much what we did with Diem. He simply announced the deposition of the president, the premier, and the entire cabinet. He summoned them to a plane. He flew them to Cairo, and they remain there to this day under close house arrest. And parenthetically, this is the same Nasser who has been complaining across the breadth of our globe about our own high-handed actions towards the will of the people in Vietnam. I'm afraid it's a case of the pot calling the kettle black. Nasser has had to pull his troops out of the Sinai, away from the border with Israel. And at the same time, this war in Yemen has built up a royalist counterfaction to Nasserite ambitions in the Far East, in the Near East. That counterfaction rests now largely on King Hussein in the Jordan, King Faisal in Saudi Arabia, with help from Bourguiba in Tunis, from the King of Morocco, and from the Shah of Iran. And the financial support for this new anti-Nasser Arab military alliance is coming from the United States and from Great Britain, which fear the growing incursion of Russian political interest and political force in the United Arab Republic. Nasser has now publicly called for the assassination of King Hussein. And there's very little likelihood of a joint Jordanian-Egyptian action against Israel. Nasser's own economy is in disarray and near bankruptcy. Inflation is rampant. The standard of living in Cairo has dropped by half in the last 2.5 years. The foreign lending agencies have denied to Mr. Nasser any further credit unless he brings into being certain specific economic reforms which the bankers of the world insist on, unless he cuts down his very expensive international military commitments. There was a group in Cairo over the last 6 months which urged Nasser to undertake these reforms and to cut down these international military commitments. Nasser's solution? To toss them all out of his government and to imprison them. He will depend increasingly and totally, if he needs be, on Russian and on Chinese military and economic aid. But there has developed in the Near East two great opposing Arab power blocs. And they are at each other's throats. As long as they are at each other's throats, Israel can breathe a little bit more easily. And finally, there is Syria. Syria is the most belligerent and bellicose of all of the neighbors of Israel today. The Syrian government is anarchy. There have been three governments in the last 8 months. Syria is on her way to becoming the first complete communist satellite in the Near East. The only effective support that the present Syrian government of General Yadid has is the Communist Party. And in return for that support, General Yadid has had to give the Red Guard almost complete power in the army. He has placed communist officers as cadre at every level of the command. And almost all of the competent officers of the Syrian army over the past 10 years were part of the losing side of the last two abortive coups, and they are now in Amman, in the Jordan, plotting some kind of revolutionary return. In the last year, Syria has been the outpost and the stooge and the satellite of Moscow. And Moscow has been willing to write a blank check for almost all Syrian undertakings. There's bitterness between Syria and Jordan. The border between these two countries is closed. War has been threatened between them. War is unlikely, but it has been threatened. Most dangerous of all, the Soviet government has given indications to the Syrian government that if Syria is provoked or attacked by Israel, the Soviet government will lend to Syria all the support that she requires. Now, in the confusion of the Near East, what is a provocation? Israel has no ambitions against Syria. Israel will not openly attack Syria. But incidents can be manufactured, and it is clear that if the Syrian government is sufficiently in turmoil, if it needs some reason to rally its people, and there is economic anarchy and inflation and confusion in the capital, it may manufacture such an incident and precipitate a war in the feeling that they have a blank check from Moscow to back up and to support every activity which originates in Damascus. But a cold-eyed view, even of the Syrian situation, would seem to indicate that war is not called for at the moment. The new Russian equipment has not yet been digested. The 700 technicians have been sent in the last 6 months. They have not had a chance to teach effectively as yet. The last two revolts have driven almost the entire professional army officer cadre into exile. The Syrian army lacks good officers, good planning. Syria lacks, in other words, the potential to launch an effective military operation against Israel. Practical considerations which seem to indicate that this is not now the hour for a Syrian attack. But passion and prejudice can overrule practical considerations. The Syrian army is massed on the Israeli-Galilean border, and Israel is vigilant against any incident. Can there be peace in the Middle East? Is Israel secure? The Israeli army is the equal of the combined armies of its neighbors. Israel has been able to purchase in the last years in Washington and in London, as well as in Paris and in Bonn, the equipment which she needs to counterbalance the Russian equipment being sent to the United Arab Republic. If the equations of deterrence give a nation security, Israel is secure. But as we know from 20 years of experience with the Cold War, deterrence can only buy time. Deterrence is not an ultimate security. You need peace. You need negotiation. You need treaty. You need arrangement. You need compromise. And none of these exist at the moment in the Middle East. In his opening report on the state of the world to the United Nations, Secretary General U Thant said that there is no sign of any diminution of tension in the Middle East. And he called for direct negotiation between the Arabs and Israel. Israel has been willing to have such direct negotiations for the last 18 years. Abba Ibn, speaking of the United Nations, again proclaimed Israel's willingness to negotiate any and all outstanding issues. And the Arabs, again, as they have done each of the last 18 years, turned down the proposal out of hand. They still dream of jihad. The Bedouins call for revenge, war to the death. Driving of the foreigner into the sea. Will there be peace in the Middle East? I'm afraid that the decision in large measure rests where I wish it did not rest, in Moscow. If the Russians desire, truly desire, coexistence with the West, a detente, they have now the political leverage in Cairo and in Damascus to insist upon it, to make it effective. But if Russia is sufficiently angered by Vietnam and is determined to open a second front to drain our resources even further, where can she do so more cheaply and more effectively and with less danger to herself than in the Middle East? And if Russia feels that she needs a safety valve for her own internal propaganda, to explain to her own people why she is not rushing to the help of the communist state of North Vietnam, her ideological brothers, then again she may find it advisable to encourage Syria or Egypt or both in some kind of wild military adventure against Israel. The long-term policy of Russia in the Middle East is clear. She hopes to dislodge the West from our 200-year-old privileged position of economic self-interest. She wants the oil, she wants the bases, she wants the communication system, she wants the landmass, she wants the opening to the Red Sea and to the Asian Ocean. She wants all of these, all that we have enjoyed during the heyday of Western imperialism. These are the Russian ambitions, and this is the Russian question mark. Now, to counterpose this, America must become more and more involved in the Middle East. And Washington is becoming more and more involved. For the first time in 18 years, during the last year and a half, Washington has allowed Israel to buy arms directly from us. Washington has been busy in the last year and a half arming the royalist opposition to General Nasser. Saudi Arabia has received guns and planes and an anti-aircraft and a missile system. Jordan has received arms in similar measure. Now there's a danger here. We are backing royalist governments. There inevitably must be reform, if not revolution, in these nations. And the arms which we are sending to Faisal and to Hussein can be very easily redeployed. Have we forgotten the lessons of Kashmir? We sent arms to Pakistan to defend the northern border with Russia. We sent arms to India to defend the northern border with China. And these arms were wheeled east and west for narrow national purposes. Well, King Faisal and King Hussein are pledged to the eradication of Israel just as much as Nasser and General Yadid. You remember what Faisal said during his unlamented visit in the spring to the United States. Just 6 weeks ago, he and another sometime erstwhile peacemaker in the Middle East and friend of Washington, Bourguiba, signed a joint statement in which they said baldly, "We are pledged to move into Israel, to destroy the Israeli government, and to replace it with one of indigenous Arabs." There is danger, then, in the arms race, even when it is being engaged in by our own side to establish a counterforce to General Nasser's. The Near East is a tinderbox. The match is lit. Are there solutions? A partial solution would be for Israel, for the United States to sign with Israel a mutual defense treaty, or to give to Israel the public assurance that Russia has given to Syria, that in case of attack, the United States will support the Israeli defense to the limits of our ability. If Syria feels that with Russian aid she can gain a cheap victory against Israel and that the United States will not intervene, she will dream that the balance is in her favor. But if Russia knows that she cannot back Syrian ambitions without drawing in the United States, and Russia has not been willing for a direct confrontation with the United States for years now, she will go much more slowly in encouraging Yadid and Damascus in their ambitions. Washington has shown great interest in the state of Israel of late, but has drawn back from the ultimate logical conclusion of our policies. It would be a step towards peace for Washington to announce that it is concerned with and will protect the integrity of Israel's borders. But the larger question remains, can there be peace in the Middle East? And I submit to you that this question must be enlarged still further. Can there be peace in the world? Actually, what is happening in the Middle East is no more and no less than what's happening in the world. Two great power blocks and some smaller power blocks confront each other bitterly, angrily. There is no compromise. There is no adjudication. There is no mediation. There is no conciliation. There are no treaties. Only brinkmanship. The equations of deterrence and the arms race. The Middle East is inexorably caught up in the Cold War. The decisions that are made in Washington and in Moscow are ultimately the decisions which will determine war and peace between Israel and her neighbors. And so we must ask ourselves, can there be coexistence between East and West? Can there be coexistence, and how can that coexistence be established? And if we fear coexistence, we consign Israel to war. And we consign ourselves to war. And if there can be coexistence, we are surely embarked in Vietnam and elsewhere on the road which leads directly away from it. Can there be peace in the Middle East? It will need to be a change of hearts and a more mature leadership in the capitals of our world. Vietnam will have to be brought to a close. Washington and Moscow will need truly to implement de-escalation of armaments, mutual aid treaties, and the like. It can be done. We share this little planet. We are all human. Every nation needs peace to build up its own domestic treasure, to build up its own domestic opportunity. It will require a degree of political maturity and impatience with ancient prejudice, which this world of ours and we, its people, have not shown ourselves capable of. But I am convinced that we are capable of it. And I am convinced that there can be peace in our world, and there can be peace in the Middle East. If we but will it, if we but work for it, if we add to our will, to our work, our prayer.